This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Coming up, the CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy tells us how changes at the state level have limited the aid available for adults who want to go back to school. But first, Western Michigan University's new medical school has a name, the Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. It has a location in downtown Kalamazoo, and now it has something that has been anticipated for years, students. The first class of 54 is now in Kalamazoo. 23 of the students are from Michigan, and others come from all over the country. Hal Jensen is the dean of Western Michigan University's Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. Hal Jensen, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk more about the medical school.
Let's talk about this first class of students. What should we know about them?
It's really a terrific group. We had over 3,500 applications for our 54 spots. We had a rigorous interview and selection process. We had over 300 applicants who came to Kalamazoo to see, at that time, the building that was under construction, but to hear from our faculty who are here and to learn about what we were doing. From that group, we've selected 54 students as our inaugural class. They are terrific in terms of their academic performance and their diversity. They come from coast to coast to coast to Alaska. So all across the U.S., really bringing a lot of different backgrounds and a lot of different strengths to the medical school.
Is that number 54 one that could grow in the future? Is the first class somewhat smaller by design, or is 54 going to be about where it's at?
It is. We had always anticipated about 50 students in the first year, and we have ended up with 54 because our curriculum is based on teams of six. And so we anticipate 54 students this year will grow over the next 3 years to a class size of 84. So 84 students in each year is our target size.
When it's a new medical school just starting, is there the opportunity to be more innovative, to perhaps try some different things? Obviously, medicine is still medicine, but can you try some different things in terms of instruction that maybe other medical schools haven't gone there yet?
Well, yes and no. It does seem like, because you have a blank slate, that you could start off and do a lot of things more creatively, and I think that's true to some extent. At the same time, when you're a new medical school, you don't have the resources of established medical schools. So it's not as easy to do some things as it is with a school that's already got all the faculty in place and got a lot of the programs in place and have a lot of things that are already there. Because whatever you decide to do, you have to create. The other aspect, though, is as you go through the accreditation process, there's a fair amount of rigor to the medical education curriculum. And even though the accrediting agencies try to encourage innovation, a lot of times to meet the accreditation standards and to meet the expectations of the review process, you end up looking a little more like traditional medical schools than a new medical school. So we have taken some best practices from a number of different schools and incorporated them in our curriculum. We've added some things that are new and unique to us, and I expect other people will take those best practices from us as they use in their curricula. And so it's a process where we learn from each other, but whether we're a new school or an existing school, we work continuously to improve the curriculum.
Do you feel that you have any more freedom to experiment because of the fact that there is not state money being used for Western Michigan University's medical school, that it's entirely privately funded? Sometimes there's strings attached to state money. Do you feel that in any way this has made things easier for you to get this off the ground?
Well, it's obviously mixed. We did not want the medical school, and this really goes back to President Dunn, when he envisioned the medical school and how it might function in Kalamazoo, did not want a medical school that would take resources from the other good things that go on at Western Michigan University. And realizing that a medical school is very expensive and it does take a lot of resources and investment, and it may take years before that investment really starts to show the financial return, that he did not want to have the medical school detract from the other good things that need to happen and are happening at Western Michigan University. So that really is the basis of why the medical school does not receive state funds.
Obviously, there were some large gifts which allowed the medical school to get off the ground. How different do you think the medical school is at this stage because there are people who have been willing to donate large sums of money?
The value of those gifts is priceless. And I often remark that this medical school, while people look at it and say, yes, it has three parents, Western Michigan University, Borges, and Bronson, I actually think there's a fourth parent in there, and that's the community. This medical school would not happen without all four of those entities contributing to start the medical school. The philanthropy that comes from this community is just exceptional. The commitment of people in this community, in this region, to give back to the community in the region is just exceptional. And it's that kind of commitment to the area that brings about even the possibility of having the medical school. Without the community and the financial support, without Western Michigan University, without Bronson, without Borges, this medical school would not be here.
You mentioned the accreditation process just a bit ago. A medical school is not fully accredited when it opens its doors. Can you kind of explain how this process works?
Well, there's several different levels and types of accreditation. We're exactly where we need to be for accreditation right now. One is we have to be granted authority from the state of Michigan to grant healthcare-related degrees, and we have that. And so that's done. The other two accreditations, one revolves around accrediting the institution, and the third revolves around accrediting the MD program. So the institutional accreditation, we are just in the midst of that process. That process takes about 4 years. We are also in the midst of our accreditation for the MD program by the Liaison Committee on Medical Education, or the LCME. The LCME was here and granted us accreditation preliminary status, and they will come back in early 2016 to visit us again to move us from accreditation preliminary status to accreditation provisional status. And then they will come back approximately 2 years later to grant full accreditation. We're going through the process that every medical school has gone through, and we're exactly where we need to be. We've done extremely well in our accreditation steps so far, and I expect we'll continue to do extremely well in the next steps. We're very well positioned to be successful.
Does the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, make this a time of change in medicine, at least in how medicine is delivered? And what does that mean for any medical school, much less one that has just started teaching classes?
Well, medicine is it's an interesting field. It reflects everything from taking care of one patient to taking care of the entire population, from the business of medicine to the art of medicine to the science of medicine. It's very complex. In the context of that complexity, one also has to realize that things are always changing. And it isn't that things have been incredibly stable for 20 or 30 or 40 or 50 years. When you take a look at the growth in scientific information, when you take a look at the advances in medicine, the changes in technology, the expense and the financial side of medicine and how that's financed and how we are able to pay for that as a society, look at the socioeconomic aspects of medical health care, and we realize that health is not just a state of physical well-being, but there are a lot of other aspects of being healthy that contribute to physical well-being. We've been living in change forever, and it will continue to change. So to think that, the Affordable Care Act, while it is significant and will have some significant impacts, that everything was unchanging before that, really isn't true. Medicine will continue to change. What is true that there will always be a need for skilled, compassionate physicians to take care of individual patients, for skilled, compassionate physicians to develop systems that take care of communities. And that's really a hands-on process. And our goal is to develop those individuals who can be the outstanding clinicians and the outstanding leaders and the outstanding advocates for healthcare for tomorrow.
Western Michigan University has opened its medical school. Other institutions have opened their medical schools, and other established medical schools are expanding, in large part because there is a projected shortage of physicians coming down the pike. Do you see the medical school here at Western Michigan University training physicians who will then work in this part of Michigan after they graduate?
Absolutely. And I think that is part of the reason, a large part of the reason why Borges and Bronson are interested in the medical school and becoming part of the medical school. If you look at the physicians in Southwest Michigan, in the region, especially around Kalamazoo and Calhoun counties, if you look at where these physicians trained, about a third of the physicians in the area have trained at what was Kalamazoo Center for Medical Studies, or KCMS, which merged into the medical school in 2012. So just imagine if those training programs that are now part of the medical school had not been here. Just imagine if a third of the physicians in the community just evaporated. And that's the impact of the training programs in the community. It serves to help recruit and retain top physicians in their fields to the area because of the value of education. And it helps bring students and residents to the area to train here. And then they see what a great place Southwest Michigan is to live. And then, again, a third of them end up staying in the area. So this is very definitely an important pipeline of physicians for the region. We're competing with the rest of the state of Michigan, but we're also competing with the rest of the country. And with the projected physician shortages, being able to train physicians in your local community is going to be key to having a pipeline of physicians for that community.
There has been a call amongst people in medical societies to raise the residency cap in hospitals. In other words, there's only so many residencies available for students coming out of medical school. Is that a concern at all as you get started that there may be limited spaces out there?
Well, let's first understand that the cap is imposed by the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services that has a cap of how many residency spots that they will fund. So residency education in the United States is very complex. A limit was set by the government in 1996. There's been a couple of modifications to that since, but largely no significant increase, even though the population's grown, even though the complexity of medicine has changed and there's a need for more physicians. There's still not an increase in the funding of graduate medical education in the U.S. Nevertheless, there's no cap on the actual number of positions, but the government only pays for so many of those positions. And so there has been some growth in the number of positions in the U.S., but those are being supported because of the commitment of hospitals to develop programs to provide that pipeline for their community. So in the United States, each year, though, when you take the number of medical student graduates, which are about 19,000 to 20,000 a year, and you look at the total number of spots, which are about 26,000 to 27,000 a year, there are a number of spots that are available. We are filling those spots with international medical graduates. So right now, at the time that we are saying we don't have enough physicians, we're also not training enough physicians. But we're also recruiting the best physicians from across the world to come to the U.S. Now, many of them do want to go back to their home countries. And that kind of international experience, I think, is a benefit for both us and for them. But many of them come here to want to stay here and practice. And that's to our benefit, but it's also to the detriment of their home countries when we're acting as a brain drain for the rest of the world. So there is a need to increase the number of medical students that are trained in the U.S., and that's increasing, and that will increase over the next 5 or 10 years. And And in about 6 or 7 years, we will reach a point where the number of projected medical student graduates will meet the number of currently available residency slots. Then at that point, then it would become more of a concern. But we're a few years away from that, but I think there's going to be a lot of change between now and then. As you know, the Institute of Medicine released last week a report on their recommendations of how funding for graduate medical education in the U.S. should change. It's going to take years to effect that change, but those kinds of changes hopefully will also lead to increased number of residency training positions.
Western Michigan University President John Dunn has said the medical school is a game changer. Do you see beyond, of course, the training of physicians, which is very important, an increased role as time goes on for things like life sciences research?
Absolutely. And, as we've started working on the medical school, our focus has had to be on the curriculum. So we have been developing the curriculum to be prepared for the students who started this week. At the same time, we've been working on our research plans. We feel, like most medical schools, that we need to address research in at least three different areas. One is basic science research, or that laboratory-based research. The second area is clinical research, or research that involves recruitment trials of patients to really be able to bring the latest and best options for therapy to Kalamazoo that are only available by participating in these studies. And then the third is community-based research that, while the word research is there, it's really the purpose is really to help improve the health of the community by partnering with affiliates and coalitions in the community that are already here and identifying how the medical school can help them. So going back to the first area of research, basic science research, we will be working this year on developing our basic science research plans and to start to remodel part of the medical school building downtown to update the labs and to recruit the first set of basic science researchers to Kalamazoo, to the medical school downtown.
Hal Jensen, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Hal Jensen is the dean of Western Michigan University's Homer Stryker MD School of Medicine. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. It is back to school time in Michigan, but a new report from the Michigan League for Public Policy finds that adults who want to go back to school for additional training and education are finding it tougher to come up with the money. Gilda Jacobs is the CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Gilda Jacobs, thank you for being with us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk a little bit about the demand out there right now. How many adults do we think are trying to, or do we have an idea of how many adults are thinking that it would be a good idea to try to get back to school, or perhaps they just have lost a job and now they realize that they do need some additional training or education?
We're really probably talking about thousands of adults that are looking for jobs right now, for different jobs. Often these are people who had jobs, perhaps in the manufacturing industry. They've lost those jobs, and they need new skills. So, we know that about a million people lost jobs in the recession, and we're kind of far behind in terms of being able to create the jobs that those folks would need in order to have higher-paying jobs.
Does Michigan's history of manufacturing jobs make Michigan perhaps a state where this is a bigger factor than it might be in other places?
Yeah, absolutely. I think Michigan does stand out because the manufacturing industry was really what was our economic engine for decades in our state. So we're often looking at people who lost jobs in the manufacturing business. And, understand there's sort of a kind of a ripple effect. It's not necessarily just those people who are working on the line, but all of the other jobs that were associated with manufacturing as well.
So we hear a lot about students getting out of high school, getting ready to go to college, and they're filling out financial aid forms, perhaps applying for student loans. In the past, have those things been there for someone who was perhaps a little older, but still thinking that they needed to go back to school, community college, or a university?
Yeah, well, actually, that's the problem. That is actually one of the reasons that we did a report on this. We know that there is still state financial aid for traditional college-age students, but right now there are no state financial aid programs to help students attend public community colleges or universities if they've been out of school for more than 10 years. So a lot of these people that now need these new skills fall into that category. And two of the existing grant programs that we have in Michigan actually are very explicit in terms of excluding folks from eligibility. And then the third grant or financial aid program is only available to people who are attending a private not-for-profit school. So that really limits the options. The good thing is that these people who are looking to get education later on can apply for Pell grants, but the Pell money isn't enough, and they're still going to be saddled with high debt at a kind of a very different time in their own lifetime as well, and at a time also that if they have kids that are starting college, they're going to have parents and kids who are then incurring debt.
Is community college, which is where many adult people may choose to go if they want training for some sort of a specific skill, they may choose a community college over a four-year university. In terms of price, is community college going up?
Well, actually, the community college tuition has really been kept much lower. It is a really, really good option for people. And sometimes people will take a two-year program at the community college and stop there and get an associate's degree. Sometimes they will then, because they've been able to save a lot of money by going to community college, then may transfer to a four-year school and finish up their last 2 years at a four-year university and get a bachelor's degree. And there's really lots of different options. There are some wonderful programs that are out there that are providing people with the skills they need to get into higher wage jobs that don't require a bachelor's degree, that certain certifications or associate's degrees will open up lots of doors for folks.
You mentioned that people may have kids going to college themselves as they're taking this step. There's, of course, a lot of things that can be in the way of an adult going back to college. Perhaps they do hold a job at the moment. They want to get a better one. If their kids are younger, there's childcare. I'm wondering if you look at all that, if you throw in financial difficulties of trying to get aid or loans, et cetera, for some people, does it just become too much and they say it's not worth it to go back to school? Is that the problem we could be facing here?
Well, I think that for some folks, they are going to feel that it's just too hard of a nut to crack in terms of the financial constraints on their family, their inability to feel that they can't put money away. Let's say they have young kids. They may feel, I can't put money away for an education account for my kids while I'm trying to pay for my own tuition, so they have to make choices. And often some of them will say, okay, well, if I get a higher paid job, that's good because once I transition into that greater job, then I'll be able to put some money away for my kids. But, it's a big, I just know with my own son-in-law, for example, he is carrying a lot of debt still from college. He's a teacher. So he's not making gobs of money. And, he has a new little son. My daughter gave birth to a new little boy 7 months ago. So, they have to balance paying off Josh's college loans and putting money away for my little grandson, Lyle.
Congratulations on the birth of your grandson, by the way.
Thank you.
One of the things I noticed in your report, too, is that sometimes these programs will have parameters that people have to meet, and those can be even tougher to meet for someone who, say, is holding a job in terms of the number of credits they have to take and that sort of thing. Is that just one more barrier in the way?
Sure. Absolutely. It's just another barrier. And what we really want to do is reduce as many of those barriers as we can to make sure that more people can go to school and get those skills so that they can upskill themselves and be able to apply for the jobs that are out there.
So what could be done from a policy level, say in Michigan, to make it easier for someone who wants to go back to school?
Well, we want to be able to restore The programs that were discontinued, you know, in 2010, we got rid of the adult part-time grant was eliminated in 2010. So we want to restore that program. We also want to be able to modify the timetable for one or both of the remaining public institution scholarships so that they could be used for part-time students or for short-term occupational programs. And then we want to, you know, look at implementing a state work-study program to connect low-income adult students to paid employment that is directly relevant to the course of study. So, you know, that's, you know, you really don't want somebody to go into a program, get all sorts of skills, learn about something, and then find that there's no jobs for what they've been in school for. So, and we also want to just, you know, really help older students, if they need to, try to fit some kind of a work-study program into their work as well as their family schedules. You know, because understand, a lot of folks that are going back to school are also working and juggling those family responsibilities.
What would that cost the state to make those changes?
For the Michigan Educational Opportunity Grant, it was a little over $2 million in 2009. The Adult Part-Time Grant was a little over $2.5 million in 2009. Remember I said that, you know, in 2010 we dropped those programs. So we're looking at, you know, less than $5 million to restore the need-based grant programs. That's not a lot of money in the big scheme of things, especially when you think of giving people the skills they need. They can go out, be in jobs that will then create more of a revenue stream for the state in the long run, because you're giving people the higher salaries, and that money goes right back into the economy. So it's a win-win for everybody.
State lawmakers and policymakers will talk a lot about the idea of retraining, and they'll talk a lot about the idea that we need a workforce which is ready for the times that we live in, those sort of things. Do you sense that there is an ear out there that's willing to listen to these ideas and that might be willing to put them into action?
Yeah, I think, you know, a whole new class of legislators will be coming to Lansing. I think it's important for them first to learn about this. I think a lot of legislators don't even understand that these programs have been eliminated. So one, our job is to educate the new class of legislators that are coming in. I think workforce development is something that is on everybody's agenda, because everybody wants jobs, you know, in Michigan. And I think most people, legislators and the public, understand that one of the greatest ways out of poverty is to have a job that pays enough money to keep your family out of poverty. So we need to do a good job of educating the new crop of legislators so that they understand that this is really going to help people right in their own districts create opportunities for more economic stimulus in their own communities and in their districts. So I think that there will be a willingness to look at this because it makes sense for legislators to want to do things that will boost their opportunities within their own district. And I'm speaking as a former legislator. I understand how this works. So our job, your job, my job, is to make sure people get it and understand that this is not so complicated.
Gilda Jacobs, thank you very much for your time.
Great. Thank you.
Gilda Jacobs is the CEO of the Michigan League for Public Policy. Links with more information can be found at wmuk.org. This is West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.